Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about the research I've been doing over the last year or so, which is to use neuroscience research to examine some of the assumptions of special education. But before I talk about that, I want to talk a little bit about how I got into this topic. For the last 15 years or so, I've been writing and studying mostly about the different ways that law structures educational opportunity. And I've been focused mostly on issues of what you might call broadly governance. And so I've looked at school desegregation, school finance, school choice, and the like, and have been mostly interested in whether and how the law can create more advantages and equalize opportunities for traditionally disadvantaged and vulnerable students. But over the last few years, I've become increasingly convinced that two developments outside the law, really, are going to be increasingly important to educational opportunity, and those are technology and neuroscience. And they're important for a lot of reasons, but in part because they offer a way to address, not solve, but to address a really vexing problem that changes in governance don't really address. And that's the problem of attracting high-quality teachers to inner-city schools and to rural schools. That is a persistent and perennial problem. And there are ways that it can be solved by offering, say, a lot more pay, but that's not likely to happen anytime soon. So one of the reasons why I think technology and neuroscience are promising is because they allow, in some ways, a workaround this problem. So technology, for example, offers at least the potential of bringing great teachers into every classroom. I don't believe that it's a panacea. I don't think you can learn by video alone. But it alleviates some pressure on attracting only high-quality teachers for every single classroom in, say, a rural area where it's difficult to staff schools. Neuroscience, in turn, I think is intriguing and promising because it offers the possibility of identifying more precisely why some kids are struggling, which can in turn be used to identify particular interventions. Often now, kids who are struggling are simply given more time on task. So if you're having trouble with reading, you do more reading. And oftentimes, it's not all that helpful. Neuroscience allows the possibility of breaking down academic tasks into their cognitive functions. And once you break down tasks into particular cognitive functions, whether it's processing words or the like, it allows you to focus on those functions and to provide more direct interventions. If you're attracted to sports analogies, it's a little bit like you could help someone who's having trouble hitting just by pitching more balls and having the person just practice swinging, or you could break the swing down to its component parts. And so you might notice once you do that that someone's having trouble moving his or her hips or moving his or her wrist. That is roughly the analogy to neuroscience. And some of this work is already happening, and some of it's happening here at UVA. David Grismer is working on some great research where he found, somewhat surprising to him anyway, connection between fine motor skills and early math skills. So if you tested kids at a young age and you tested their fine motor skills, that correlated with their math skills when they're a little bit older. So fine motor skills, tracing patterns and the like, or being able to manipulate small objects. And the theory is that it's the same part of the brain that prepares you for math that also controls fine motor skills. And so he and colleagues developed an after-school program that didn't give kids more math problems, but required them to trace patterns or to build, to replicate a Lego statue. And lo and behold, when they were tested, their math scores rose. Now, this is interesting to me and promising to me because what it suggests is that if you understand the cognitive components of academic tasks and can focus on them, You may not need the spectacular teacher in order to train struggling students to improve those cognitive functions, right? It doesn't take a master teacher to run an after-school program where the kids are basically playing with Legos, which is an oversimplification, but you get the idea. So my first foray into the topic of neuroscience and education has been to look at special education. And somewhat surprisingly to me, when I started studying this, is that there hasn't been that much written about it. Lawyers have definitely discovered neuroscience, both within the legal academy and outside of it. There have been 700 articles and books written in the last 20 years. Neuroscientific evidence is showing up in more and more trials, especially criminal trials. And a lot of the research is focused on fundamental issues like criminal responsibility. To what extent is someone who has some kind of brain malfunction actually responsible for his or her behavior? Others have focused on the ability of neuroscience to provide more precise lie detection. So I understand why there are some very big issues that neuroscience can inform, very big legal issues. But it's a little bit odd that it hasn't been focused on, attention hasn't been focused on special education, because special education rests on a number of assumptions about how the brain develops and functions and how it can sometimes malfunction. And neuroscience research is relevant to those assumptions. And so the research that I've been doing is really looking at the neuroscience to see whether it is consistent with the assumptions that underlie special education. And in some instances, it is not. And I'm just going to give you two examples, one involving students with learning disabilities and one involving students with emotional problems. Fortunately or unfortunately for you, this requires some background information about special education. Angela should really be giving this portion of the talk because she knows the law much better than I do. The main statute that provides protection and services for special education students is known as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or the IDEA. It's not the only statute that's relevant. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA are also relevant, but the IDEA is the main game in town. It's the main statute that protects students with disabilities. And it is an incredibly complicated statute that offers both procedural safeguards and some substantive rights. But the basic gist of it is pretty easy to understand. Students who are eligible for coverage are entitled to a free, appropriate public education, otherwise known as FAPE. This is the statute that is filled with more acronyms than any other statute outside of environmental law, perhaps. And FAPE is delivered through an individualized education plan, or, as you would have guessed, an IEP. And the IEP is supposed to offer a personalized plan that meets the student's academic and social or emotional needs. So it's developed with parents and teachers and special education specialists in order to provide the sort of education that's designed to meet the student's needs. In addition, the statute requires that students be educated in the least restrictive environment possible, and it offers some disciplinary protections. The key to all of this is, at the beginning anyway, whether you're eligible. And eligibility is determined on the basis of whether you meet one of the 13 disability definitions or fall into one of the 13 categories. The biggest category in terms of the number of students involved is the specific learning disabilities category, which encompasses about 40% of all special education students. Learning disabilities, a specific learning disability is defined as a disorder in one or more psychological processes involved in understanding or using language. Dyslexia is a common example. More generally, I think you can think of it as covering students who have what you would call a cognitive processing deficit. It excludes from coverage, somewhat curiously, those whose learning problems are primarily the result of, among other things, economic disadvantage. And this exclusion reflects the belief, which is longstanding, that learning disabilities are innate. That is, those who have learning disabilities are born with faulty wiring. Those who are poor, by contrast, might face external difficulties that reduce opportunities to learn and might reduce the motivation to learn. But they're different, so the statute presupposes, from someone with an internal problem. The difficulty with this is that it's very hard to identify someone with a learning disability. The tests used to identify kids with learning disabilities are not especially reliable. They don't often manifest themselves the way measles would manifest themselves or a tick bite would. And so the difficulty of identifying someone with a true learning disability and distinguishing that person from someone who shows a lot of the same deficits, that is, they're both doing poorly in school, for example, combined with the exclusion of students whose learning problems are due to economic disadvantage, is that the exclusion can operate as a sort of presumption. That is to say, if you've got a poor kid who's doing poorly in school, an obvious explanation is that, oh, it's because of the conditions related to poverty. That explains why the kid is doing poorly in school. And because it's difficult to discount that possibility, it can lead to kids who really do have learning disabilities, but who are poor, it can lead to them being excluded from coverage. So this is where the neuroscience comes in. So neuroscientists have been able to map the brain to a certain extent, and this is going to explode in the next 10 years if the Obama administration's plan takes hold. They're supporting putting a lot of money behind mapping all the brain functions, just like the project to map the human genome. But at the moment, there's a good deal of knowledge of which portions of the brain are responsible for different cognitive functions or responsible for controlling behavior or controlling emotions. And these have been tracked through behavioral tests, EEGs, PET scans, and MRIs, which basically identify which areas of the brain are responsible for different functions. So the hippocampus, for example, is responsible for working memory, the prefrontal cortex for executive function, which is a cluster of abilities related to planning and controlling impulsive behavior. And so there's an ability now to identify particular cognitive functions and to link them up to particular areas of the brain. That's an oversimplification, but it also exhausts my limited knowledge of neuroscience. I used to know all the terms in the paper that I wrote, but my hippocampus isn't what it used to be. That way. Most importantly, for purposes of this project, recent neuroscience research suggests that external factors can have internal physical effects on brain development and function. Now, we've known this for a long time. That is, we've known that someone who suffers from brain trauma or someone who is exposed to lead poisoning will suffer internal damage to the brain. What the recent neuroscience research is suggesting is that additional factors can also have internal effects. And researchers have been documenting how conditions associated with poverty, like exposure to toxins, chronic stress, and lack of cognitive stimulation, especially in the homes, can produce measurable internal damage to brain development and function. I won't go through all the studies, but suffice it to say that there's increasing agreement among neuroscientists who study this based on different strands of research that, this is as one team put it, who we are is determined not only by genetically programmed development, neurodegenerative disease, and psychoactive drugs, but also by the socioeconomic circumstances of our childhoods in equivalently physical mechanistic ways. The conditions associated with poverty, you might think of as a bit like lead poisoning, insofar as those external circumstances can have internal effects. Interestingly, the studies tend to show that that there are not overall deficits among poor students or lower SES students, but that some cognitive functions are impaired more than others, specifically those needed for language development, working memory, and executive function. In other words, poverty seems to impact some portions of the brain, not others. And if you think back to the learning disabilities category, it is for specific learning disabilities. And one of the hallmarks is that a student has a particular problem, a particular weakness, but not overall weakness. That is, there's usually a distinction made between someone who has a problem just with reading versus someone who overall is slow. And what the research is suggesting is that a lot of poor kids, or some poor kids anyway, look an awful lot like the learning disabled kid insofar as some cognitive functions are impaired, but not others. So a caution and some clarifying points. The research is nascent, and the causal links are not completely established. There are correlations. There's not causation. But there's enough research, I think, anyway, to call into question the idea that there's a sharp distinction between internal and external causes of learning disabilities. And it calls into question specifically the notion that kids whose learning problems are caused by economic disadvantage do not have learning disabilities. That is, the effective presumption in the law, which relies on the idea that poor kids just face external problems but don't have internal problems, seems difficult to justify in light of the research. Now, three clarifying points. This is not to suggest that all poor kids are learning disabled, far from it. Some suffer from the effects of poverty, others don't. The point is simply that the presumption, the exclusion of poor kids who are having learning problems as not learning disabled seems difficult to justify. The second point is that internal does not mean permanent or beyond help. The brain, especially the developing brain, is remarkably adaptable. It's remarkably plastic, as it's called in the research. Whether a learning disability is innate or caused by an external disability doesn't mean that there's no hope. There are still interventions that can be successful in helping helping the child to improve in academic performance or in behavior. The third clarifying point is that what to do in response to the research is not completely obvious. The most obvious thing is to just get rid of the exclusionary clause that excludes kids who have economic disadvantage and just remove that from consideration altogether. But simply lifting the exclusion could lead to a drastic increase in the number of students eligible for special education, which might in turn overwhelm the system. It may be instead that special education itself has to change in order to accommodate more students being eligible. One possible way it could change is actually already apparent in the law, and that is to treat first, classify second. It's an oversimplification. That is, you respond to the kids who are struggling and offer them some forms of assistance before going through the process of diagnosing them and classifying them as learning disabled or not. And so the law has been changed recently to allow states to use, this is just one example of a couple, to allow states to use up to 15% of the funds that they get for special education on what are called early intervening services. And these are given to young kids who are having trouble, and they are not yet found eligible for special education. They're simply having trouble. And that model might actually work on a broader scale for students who are having learning problems. That is, rather than trying to make the difficult decision that, yes, this person has a learning disability and this person doesn't, you can provide services to students who are having having trouble. There are dangers to this that we can talk about in the question and answer, but and there is another example. But let me go on to the second example regarding students with emotional problems. So the category at issue here is emotional disturbance, or ED. And the definition, I'm sorry, this is a little bit elaborate, but it's important to read. Emotional disturbance is defined in the regulations as a condition exhibiting one or more of the following characteristics over a long period of time and to a marked degree that adversely affects a child's educational performance. The regulations then go on to list five characteristics, any one of which would qualify the student for special education, provided that the condition is sufficiently long, severe, and affects the student's performance. So these are the five characteristics. One, an inability to learn that cannot be explained by intellectual, sensory, or health factors. Two, an inability to build or maintain satisfactory interpersonal relationships with peers and teachers. Three, inappropriate types of behavior or feelings under normal circumstances, which I think could include at times most of us. Four, a general pervasive mood of unhappiness or depression. And five, a tendency to develop physical symptoms or fears associated with personal or school problems. So any one of those five characteristics would count as emotional disturbance, provided, again, that they're long, severe, and they affect a student's educational performance. You could criticize those factors, to be sure, as somewhat vague, but they at least point in the right direction. The definition ends, though, by doubling back on itself and becoming almost incoherent, if not completely incoherent. We learn that emotional disturbance includes schizophrenia, which would not be surprising to many. But then we also learn that the term emotional disturbance does not apply to children who are, and this is the key term, socially maladjusted. This is the kicker, unless it's determined that they also have an emotional disturbance. Now, one of the real mysteries is that social maladjustment is not defined. The second problem is that any reasonable definition of social maladjustment would include a number of the same factors that are used to define emotional disturbance. So a student who has an inability to maintain satisfactory relationships with peers and teachers, or a student who has exhibits inappropriate behavior under normal circumstances, would by most definitions be considered socially maladjusted, which means that the same way that you would define socially maladjusted would also be the way that you define emotional disturbance, which means that the same factor or characteristics could be used to both include a student in special education and exclude a student from special education, and then include again, because you can be eligible if you're both socially maladjusted and have an emotional disturbance. So it's as if the law said, you're included if you wear red pants, but you're not included if your pants are red, unless you happen to be wearing red pants. That's basically the approach. Schools, unlike academics, can't sit back and just bemoan the fact that the definition is incoherent, and instead they have to try to operationalize it and distinguish between students who are socially maladjusted and students who are emotionally disturbed. And what schools have done, essentially, is come up with two different ways of looking at it that are related. One is that they've defined socially maladjusted students as those who exhibit externalizing behaviors and those who are emotionally disturbed as exhibiting internalizing behaviors. So the kid who acts out and is aggressive to his peers or his teachers, socially maladjusted. The kid who is withdrawn and apprehensive, emotionally disturbed. The second related way is to equate social maladjustment with behavioral disorders, specifically conduct disorder and oppositional defiant disorder. And these disorders aren't really so much a diagnosis as a description of symptoms, which include, as the disorders suggest, defiant behavior, aggressive, impulsive behavior towards others. The underlying link between these two different approaches and the distinction between social maladjustment and emotional disturbance has to do with the concept of volition. That is to say, the underlying premise between those who are considered socially maladjusted and emotional disturbance often turns on the idea that those who are socially maladjusted are choosing to behave in a particular way that's inappropriate, whereas those who have an emotional disturbance are not. And here again, neuroscience research is relevant. And it suggests that the belief that some kids are simply choosing to behave badly is at least questionable. And again, I won't go into all the details, but neuroscientists have identified a number of neurobiological markers and causes for oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder. That is, there are differences in brain function and brain development of students who have been identified as having these disorders. There's a separate strand of research that's been very relevant in the juvenile sentencing and juvenile death penalty cases, and the Supreme Court's actually cited it a fair bit in those cases. And that evidence indicates that adolescents are prone to risky and defiant behavior because of the way their brains develop. That is, the reward-seeking portion of your brain develops at a faster pace than the control portion of your brain. So you have these impulses that later you'll be able to control, but when you're a teenager, it's harder for you to control. And the long and short of it is that those who consistently act out, I don't mean just an occasional outburst, but those who consistently act out may not be choosing their behavior any more than the kid who is depressed is simply choosing not to look on the bright side of life. I'm not saying, I emphasize or want to stress, I'm not saying that some or most teenagers lack free will and are just automatons driven by an overdeveloped limbic system and an underdeveloped prefrontal cortex. I'm simply saying that distinguishing those who choose to misbehave and those who have no choice may be a lot more difficult than schools seem to think. And to the extent that schools are relying on the idea that some kids are choosing to misbehave and therefore are socially maladjusted and others are not and therefore are emotionally disturbed, may be a difficult line to draw. Last point, there's a link here to poverty as well. It's hard to document, but Angela and others who are closer to this than I am have told me that there's some reason to believe that schools are more inclined to classify poor kids as socially maladjusted on the belief that they haven't been properly socialized. So a poor kid from a single parent home, for example, the idea is that child may not have been taught exactly well how to behave. And so the misbehavior is a result of that external circumstance, just like the poor achievement might be a result of that external circumstance. But recall, as I mentioned, the research indicating that growing up in poverty can have a lasting impact on brain development and function. And one area is the prefrontal cortex that is responsible for executive function. And executive function, in turn, is important not only for planning, which is related to all sorts of academic activities, but also to controlling impulsive behavior. And so if it's the case that conditions related to poverty can impact the development of the prefrontal cortex, the poor student who misbehaves may be suffering not just from poor socialization, but from the impact of poverty that has had an internal effect on the child's brain and development. The question, again, is what to do about this. And if the research suggests that there are actually many more kids who have who ought to be eligible for the emotional disturbance category under existing definitions, what do you do about that in response? And I've already talked more than I should, but suffice it to say, and we talk about this more, it may be that a similar strategy to the learning disability strategy would work here as well. That is, providing assistance more in the behavioral realm than the academic realm for the student who is misbehaving in school, rather than waiting to provide assistance unless and until that student is classified as emotionally disturbed. So with that, I will hand it over to someone who actually knows how special education works. Thanks.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be back at UVA, except for the flashbacks I'm having to Fed courts with the, so you'll excuse me if my knees shake a little bit while I'm talking. It's also a real pleasure to get to listen to Jim talk. I actually didn't get a chance to be a student in one of his lecture classes because he was visiting at another school. And so it's really fun to come back and get a chance to absorb all of his expertise. So like all practitioners, I'm going to start out with a disclaimer. We start out with disclaimers before everything we do. I'm not an educator. I'm not a neuroscientist. In fact, everything I know about the human brain comes from a lecture I heard from a JMU professor last summer in which we modeled a neuron by holding up our hands and said, this is the nucleus, this is the axon, these are dendrites, and when you put two together, you have a synapse. And that's pretty much what I know, except from reading some of the work that Jim has done and listening to some of the papers on adolescent development and how it relates to juvenile justice. So what I have learned and can apply, I guess, to special education law really comes from about 12 years of experience representing students, low-income students, in special education cases. It's only a part of what I do, so I'm not even the expert that a lot of people are in special education law. But the conclusion that I've drawn over the years is that IDEA really asks educators to do the impossible. The law provides privileges and resources to students who it assumes have internal deficiencies over which they have little control, and excludes students whose deficiencies are caused by external factors or their own bad behavior. And so we ask educators to do what science cannot even do yet so far, determine the cause of a learning deficit. Is it due to trauma or economic disadvantage or poor parenting or some sort of faulty wiring? Decide why a child misbehaves. Is it due to a disability or is it normal teenage misbehavior or something more sinister and premeditated? So what I want to do is give you a couple of concrete, specific examples from real life and our practice of how that plays out and how difficult those decisions are to make, to talk about some of the consequences of the incoherence that Jim described, and then talk about some of the implications for policy, I think, that the neuroscience has that Jim started to talk about. So first example, let's take a 16-year-old. A 16-year-old with low average intelligence has a history of reading problems starting in the third grade, never evaluated for special education, no disagreement over whether he would benefit from individualized reading instruction, only disagreement is whether he's entitled to that. And so he's already got two strikes against him. And the first strike is, in order to be eligible for special education, you have to demonstrate, or as a student with a learning disability, you have to demonstrate that his reading deficits are not due to his overall low intellectual disabilities or abilities, but instead are due to a specific learning disability in reading. And so for decades, the way you would demonstrate that is that you would show that there was a large, through IQ testing and achievement testing, you would show that there's a large discrepancy between his abilities and where you would expect his achievement to be and his actual achievement in reading. So if you have a student whose overall intelligence is low average, it's much harder to show a large gap between where we expect them to be performing and where they are actually performing. Does that mean that he doesn't have a reading deficit? No. Does that mean that he can't learn to read? No. But does that mean that he's not entitled to the reading instruction that he needs? Yes, potentially. So he's got a second strike against him. He's 16. He can't read. Do we think he's a model student? No. What do we think his behavior and attendance records look like? Pretty poor, right? He's tuned out, he's disruptive when he comes to school, half the time he doesn't come to school. Now, is all of that a symptom of his disability, or is that the cause of his low reading performance? That's what the schools are being asked to determine at the eligibility table. And how are they supposed to know? Let's talk about the second example. A student raised by a single parent has a long history of disruptive behavior and attendance problems. Let's say his diagnosis is adjustment disorder with mixed disturbance of emotion and conduct. How many people think that is an emotional condition? Okay, a few. How many people think that that's a conduct disorder or social maladjustment? How many people think it's both? How many people are totally stumped? Okay, so now you know how the schools feel. Is that a student who should be eligible is having an emotional condition, assuming he meets one of the five the characteristics that Jim read in the definition of emotional disability? Or is he not eligible because he has characteristics of social maladjustment? Now, one way to interpret the exclusion is that if you have both, you're eligible. As you know, that was Jim's red pants example. Another way to interpret the exclusion is that if you have both, and this is the way the Fourth Circuit has interpreted it, is that parents must prove the critical causal connection between the student's emotional condition and their poor performance and educational deficiencies. Now, so how do you go about doing that? Especially assuming that when we look at the research, the behavioral manifestations of social maladjustment and an emotional condition look very similar. Do you rely on stereotypes about and assumptions about children in poverty and their home life, their parenting skills, their character? Some of the studies that have been done and had teachers and other evaluators fill out checklists have actual students and look at their characteristics and have not been able to consistently distinguish between those students who have social maladjustment or students who have an emotional disability. Now, some schools some of the schools that when we represent students, use a behavioral checklist to try to make this determination and try to avoid those stereotypes and be a little bit more objective about it. I'm not sure that that's successful. So the way that works is let's picture a teacher or a parent fills out a series of questions, a questionnaire about the student's behavior. And then those questions are scored and basically arrayed into two columns, where one column would include sort of internalizing characteristics, inability to control behavior, disability type characteristics, things like that. And then the other column is more externalizing, aggressive behavior type characteristics. And if you have more things that fall in kind of the aggressive behavior, intentional behavior column, externalizing characteristics, they say, well, that looks like more like social maladjustment. And if you have more in sort of the classic traditional signs of depression or anxiety, you're in the emotional condition category, and that's how we decide. So let me give an example from a real questionnaire that one of our clients' teachers had to fill out. So let's say the student has attendance problems. The teachers fill out the checklist. They have to decide whether the student, quote, misses school due to emotional issues or exceeds allowed absences due to truancy. Another example, student acts out. This teacher has to decide whether the behavior is intentional with features of anger and rage or, quote, unable to comply with school expectations. And so how the teacher interprets that behavior will decide whether the student has an emotional condition that would make them eligible for special education or is simply socially maladjusted, and that's the cause of their learning problems. When you look at the DSM-IV, which is kind of the guidebook for classifying and understanding the symptoms of mental disorders, you actually see that mood disorders in adolescence manifest themselves in irritability. They're frequently associated. Depression in adolescence is frequently associated with disruptive behavior disorders and anxiety. And so you have a lot of overlap between these characteristics, and it's just really not as clear cut as simply drawing two columns and saying it's either one or the other. And in fact, if you go by the classic traditional signs of depression, insomnia or oversleeping, being socially withdrawn, crying, things like that, you're actually going to miss a lot of students, a lot of teenagers in particular, who are exhibiting signs of a mood disorder. So those two were examples about eligibility. I also want to talk about give an example about the manifestation determination review. And so just to give you a little background, when a student with a disability misbehaves and is suspended for more than 10 days, the schools have to determine whether the behavior that they're being suspended for is a manifestation of their disability. And there are three questions that they have to go through. Was the behavior caused by the disability? Was it directly and substantially related to the disability? Or was it a direct failure a direct result of the school's failure to implement the IEP? And if any one of those questions is yes, then the school cannot change the student's placement and has to return them to school. So those are pretty hard questions to answer. So let's take an example, a six-year-old student with a developmental disability, which is kind of a catch-all for a young student who has a disability and has not met developmental milestones, but we're not going to identify them with a particular disability yet because we're not sure whether they will overcome that and meet those milestones or exactly what's going on with them. The student's playing a card game with another student. The student throws a tantrum because the other student takes all the cards. The teacher intervenes. The student kicks the teacher. Is that a manifestation of the student's disability? So the schools actually try to make this really simple. Did the student have volition? That is, could the student control his leg when he kicked it? Well, yes. The answer to that is yes. Did the student know it was wrong? Pretty sure if you asked the student, he knew it was wrong to kick the teacher. Was there a purpose to the behavior? Yes, he was trying to get the cards back. In fact, the schools, and I sort of blame this on their lawyers, I think they train them to ask these questions. So after a student misbehaves, they'll say, now, Johnny, did you know that was the wrong thing to do? Yes, I knew that was the wrong thing to do. Now, Johnny, what were you trying to accomplish when you did that? Well, I was trying to get the cards back. Now, even if the student had no purpose for the behavior, most people, including kids, don't like other people to think that their behavior is irrational. So they will come up with an explanation for the behavior, whether it was actually the explanation at the time that the behavior occurred or not. And so the schools will say, well, the student had a reason, and the behavior was designed to accomplish that. Therefore, the student intended the behavior, and it's not a manifestation of their disability. It's actually not that simple. One question you might ask is, does this six-year-old student with a developmental delay have verbal communication delays? Did he not have the words to explain to the other student or to the teacher that this game had become unfair? Does he have low frustration tolerance? Is that one of the goals of his IEP is supposed to work on? In all of the cases I just described, you have a student with an undeniable need. But instead of asking schools to try to meet those needs, we ask them to make judgments about whether the students deserve the special education support and resources, and whether the student deserves to be served. Are they a student with a disability, or in the words of the Fourth Circuit, a garden variety juvenile delinquent? The fact is, though, there's no test that can reliably distinguish between social maladjustment and a real emotional disability, and no test that can determine whether a particular behavior was caused by a disability or is just a teenager exercising poor judgment or being hard-headed or a toddler throwing a tantrum because he didn't get his way. I think there are some consequences to that incoherence, and what we see on the ground is that when the law doesn't make any sense or it doesn't fit human experience, people just don't apply it very well. And you see all these extra legal, especially in close cases, you see all these extra legal considerations coming into play and having an impact on eligibility and other legal determinations. For example, in cases on the margins, you might see fewer students found eligible if the school district is trying to lower its enrollment rates. They might use the checklist I described, or rigorous use of the exclusion to try to keep kids out. Has the district been cited for having disproportionate minority enrollment in special education? That might cause them to scrutinize cases for minority eligibility, cases for minority students more and cases for white students less. Does the school have resources other than special education to help struggling students? And I actually think this is a really big one. If not, they may be more inclined to use special education supports and ignore the exclusions for economic disadvantage or social maladjustment. is the student a behavior problem? And does the school want to maximize their discipline flexibility? Because there are some limitations on the school's discretion to discipline students. And that's why you see so much local variation, I think, in special education enrollment among localities. And then last, I just want to talk about a few of the implications for policy. I think there's some real positives to the neuroscience. Students whose learning problems are the result of poverty and stress shouldn't be excluded from the services and supports that they need. On the other hand, I think there's some troubling aspects to it. One is that there seems, and Jim mentioned this as well, there seems to be more research on identifying the effects of poverty on the brain than there is about remedying the effects. We know that brains can change. We know that neurons that are planted in an enriching environment can grow more dendrites and more connections and can become, have ability to be plastic and recover from being in a sterile environment where they kind of wither on the vine. But is there a window of opportunity for that? And what happens if we miss it in a child's life? Do we just give up on those children? I really worry about that. And then similarly, how could equating or associating poverty and disability affect our expectations for students and for school performance in the students in the schools that serve students and have high concentrations of poverty? I often see in our cases disability used as an excuse for low student outcomes. And I worry, does neuroscience start to justify similar outcomes for low-income students? And maybe the expectations for those students are so low already that this doesn't make it any worse. And then finally, one of the implications for policy that Jim mentioned is that if you remove the exclusion and special education enrollment explodes, maybe you need to think about restricting traditional special education and all of the panoply of procedural protections and other services that students are entitled to a smaller subset of those who are more severely disabled, and then give I'll call it special education light, but more early intervening services in response to intervention, some specialized instruction to students who have less severe disabilities, but you don't entitle them to the full array of procedural protections. How do you police that? The way that IDEA works and supposedly guarantees good outcomes, although that this is very imperfect, is through providing private rights of action and procedural safeguards to parents and students. For other students, we have the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which relies more on the outcomes in a school and school-level accountability, requires schools to meet certain benchmarks for subgroup performance, for example, for one of the subgroups being economically disadvantaged students. So these students would not be subject to IDEA protections. And increasingly, we are seeing we're seeing that the ESEA is probably going to be changed to really focus on the lowest performing students. How do you guarantee that, what incentives do schools have to make sure that these students are served well and that we're not just lowering our expectations for them by sort of enrolling them in special education light? And so those are some of the questions that I think the science raises, and I'm sure you all have questions as well.